This is the second half-hour section of the discussion of end-of-life issues at Congregation of Tevoch Shalom in Berkeley, California.
Thank you. I want to pick up, Nicole, on one thing you said about listening, you know, being sure to try to listen to the dying person. One of the things that's striking about the Yehuda Hanasi story is that we don't hear his voice. Here's this brilliant, articulate man who doesn't say a word through this story about his own condition, about his own preferences, and so on. Maybe the truth has been kept from him. We hear that the disciples have threatened to kill anyone who talks about him as dead or dying, perhaps. There's no way to tell what he wants. Nobody actually asks him. And in fact, the Midrash starts out as this struggle between the disciples and the angels, and each one's pulling him in their own way for their own reasons, that although their loving reasons are fundamentally selfish reasons as well. So this, what this opens is the question of how the feelings and interests and concerns of all the others involved should be taken into account, and how can they make sure to hear what the dying person has to say. So I want to turn to Joanna now and ask you for your thoughts about this, and also about, are there ways to help us do this more effectively? Are there tools that we have available to us? Are there consistent, although there's not one size fits all, as we've heard, are there predictable ways that to make these conversations go better?
Well, I guess the first thing I would say is that conversation is the most important thing. And just very, very quickly in terms of the cultural issue, that's, it's really important for the medical people at that point, at the point of the person near death or, in a near-death situation, to understand what the cultural issues for the family and the individual are, and not to sort of assume that there are issues that everybody knows and everybody wants to know. That's a very brief issue. But the sort of, as a lawyer and as somebody who's looked at these issues a lot, there are certainly ways to initiate conversations. And this is, I guess, one of the concerns and one of the issues that I look at very closely and think about a lot. There's certainly way, I think it's very important to initiate conversations very early for all of us, really, at a very young age, and it's certainly when we're young adults, adults in the position that all of you are in. There are formal documents. There are, and you've probably all heard about these. There are things called advance directives, living wills. I mean, they have lots and lots of names, and I'll just very quickly go through them. Excuse me. A living will is a document, a formal document, where you can state your preferences. There are really formal ones where you sort of check boxes and tell somebody, tell, the world, tell your loved ones, tell your physicians exactly what you want. Do you want or do you not want what sometimes is called extraordinary care? Do you want resuscitation? Do you want this? Do you want that? So that's one thing. And then there's something called an advance directive, where you choose a proxy to carry out those wishes, to tell people if you're not able to document, to say exactly what you want, if you're unconscious, if you're incompetent. So those are basically the two kinds of documents that you can fill out. I'll come back to that in a minute. And then there's a third kind of document called a pulsed, a physician order for life-sustaining treatment, which is something that's come along relatively recently, a physician order for life-sustaining treatment, which is something which and Jeff can say a little bit more about that, which hospitals now have to develop policies for, physicians have to honor, emergency departments have to honor. And this is basically a document where which requires hospital to honor advanced directives. That's correct? Mm-hmm. But I have some strong feelings about these documents. I think that they come back to the importance of having a conversation. Yes, you know, you need to document something in writing, and the most important thing is that you choose somebody to carry out your wishes if you're unable to do so. But the really important thing is that the conversation take place. It doesn't really do any good to sit down and check boxes. And actually, a lot of research has shown that checking boxes, I mean, because there are so many situations, there's so many contingencies that can take place now, that it doesn't really do any good to say, you know, I want resuscitation. Well, you don't know what can happen to possibly require resuscitation. So it's most important to have a conversation. And the conversation is what really is important to take place. I did a really interesting study some years ago looking at people who had done advanced directives and filled out these forms, and the older people who were in really great health, and they had done these forms some years before. And what I was curious about was whether 7, 8, 10 years later, whether they had the same opinions that they had earlier. And so I sat down and interviewed them. And that was the subject of the study. That was what I wanted to find out. And they all had the same opinions. And then I went and asked them where the documents were and who their proxies were and who they'd had conversations with. And to my surprise, they said things like, well, my lawyer has them because it's with my will. And then they would say, I have another copy somewhere. I'm not really sure where it is. And I said, well, who else did you talk to? Or who's your proxy? Well, my children are. So I'd say, well, have you talked to your children? Oh, no, I don't want them to know about this. I don't want them to deal with death. Right. So the conversation again. It's so important to have a conversation and have a conversation with not only with the people who you name as your proxy, but with your close caregivers, or your close family. I mean, those are the people who are going to be there when you need them. And
can I interrupt and just talk?
Yes.
I just want to tell a little example of how this has played out for me in practice, because I couldn't agree with Joanna more about this. I take care of people with AIDS, and especially early on when treatment wasn't terribly good, and many of my patients were at high risk of getting a particular kind of pneumonia that can be very severe. You know, I'd have conversations with people where they bring in their advanced directives form, and they'd almost all check off the box that said they didn't want life support. Okay? And I started having conversations with people, and I would ask them things like, well, you know, there's this kind of pneumonia that's quite common, and when people get it, it can be really, really bad. But we know how to treat it, and we can treat it very effectively. And sometimes it's so bad that the only way to survive is that you need to be on a breathing machine for 3 or 4 days while we treat it, and then we get you off the breathing machine. Would you want that? Of course I'd want that. Who wouldn't want that? Well, you just check the box here saying, you know, under no circumstances do I want to be on a machine. To which the answer was, well, that wasn't what I meant. So the trouble is, of course, the boxes don't really tell us much about these unpredictable, unforeseeable circumstances in which we end up finding ourselves. I couldn't agree more with Joanna about the importance of making sure that people understand the basis. It's not that these decisions that these patients had made were incorrect or didn't reflect their values. But as you drew those conversations out, what they really meant was, if I'm in really bad shape and there's not really hope of meaningful recovery in a reasonable period of time, notice there are a lot of qualifying adjectives in there, right? Even so, that in those conditions, I don't want to be on a machine. Okay.
And a couple of other things. where should this document be? Any document? Well, certainly it does do no good if you don't know where it is, and it doesn't really do much good if it's with your lawyer, who's not going to be reachable in the middle of the night, unless your lawyer is a good friend. So your proxy, other good friends, somebody else. And something I've been thinking about a lot is here. Why not create a system where everybody has a file here? There's no reason why not, and that's something we ought to talk about. I did have a conversation with Rabbi Kelman, and I know, and he was very funny, because I said, I thought he and I had had a conversation sometime earlier, and that he said there was a file here. And there apparently isn't. But he has some advance directives of people that he's talked to here, and he has them at home. Well, that doesn't do any good because he's retired. So that doesn't help. So I said, get them over to the synagogue. But that's something we ought to be talking about here. And as I've thought about this, and we're talking about healthy dying, and this is something else that happened to me once when I was giving one of these talks in a nursing home. And there was a woman who stood up, and she must have been in her late 90s, and she said, I just want to die healthy. And I thought about that, and I thought, okay, we need an advance directive for aging. There's no reason why we shouldn't have, I mean, we should have this conversation about aging. We should have a conversation not just about dying, but all of us should sit down and talk with people about how we want to age. There was a series of stories on NPR this week about all of the things, all of the technology that exists or is about to exist for aging. You can have little bells that ring and children far away can know when their parents take their medication and don't and open the refrigerator and, oh my God, this is, you know, there could be such control. Is that what people want? So have this conversation. It's not just about dying. And the other thing, and I'll close with this, is the conversation also is not just about the medical parts of dying or aging. It's about what are the things on your mind for your proxy, for your family, and for you. It's about the other things that are on your mind. Are you worried about your finances? Are you worried that you're going to run out of money to take care of you? Are you worried about the impact on your family if you die? When my mother was dying, one of the things that, other than money, and she was very worried about that, one of the things that was really gripping her was my sister was single, and she had always, her whole life, worried about me taking care of her. And one of the last things that she said to me was, make sure you take care of Diane. I mean, she wasn't really worried about herself. She was just worried about my sister. So have that conversation, too. What are people worried about? Because they may not be worried so much about their medical care. So anyway, that's part of the conversation. Thanks.
Allison, I wanted to ask you about a couple of things. So one, just taking off on what Joanna just mentioned, you've devoted a lot of effort to helping people talk about what they're worried about in those circumstances. And I wonder if, Nicole talked about listening to the dying person. Are there particular things that are on most people's list, that always need to be elicited or that you try to encourage people to talk about? And then the second thing I'd like you to address also is, we've talked a little bit about this changing idea of hopefulness or changing meaning of hopefulness. What does it mean to be hopeful for someone who's dying or for those around that person?
Let me say something about the hopefulness first. This is one of those things that because the cultural understanding of hope, and sometimes even the religious or spiritual understanding of hope, is equated with lengthening life. People often, let's say the person who's facing dying feels very embarrassed or very stigmatized to not feel the wish to continue to go on, not feel that kind of hope. And so it's a huge relief for that person to begin to be able to have a conversation in a support group or with an individual at the bedside with a chaplain about how it may be that the person actually has his or her own ideas about hope if it's allowed to be said, or the person can be offered some thoughts like hope for a peaceful death, hope for being surrounded by loved ones, hope for support to make tshuva. You know, there are hope that they'll see their loved ones. My grandmother, when she was dying, said to me, you know, they say you see your family. And for her, that was her bridge. And for me, it was incredibly comforting to know that she had that inside. And so we can help people discern what their own meanings are of hope versus the despair of either, well, I'm going to die, so there's no hope, or the despair of, I'm not allowed to have hope that looks different from the wish to continue to go on.
Did you want to say something about that, Nicole?
To give another kind of counterweight to that, there's oftentimes the people in the hospital who want to do everything possible to continue to live and to try everything, sometimes beyond the opinions of some of those who are providing their care or some family members. And there can be the words used of, you know, but there's no hope, right? And, you know, because of this and this and this technological and this, you know, medical and all these different pieces of information that are in the other person's perspective, saying that there's no hope. And I think one of the ways that I like to make sure we remember what hope is that hope is not because of information. We don't have hope because information or opinion tells us to. Hope is despite information. Hope is not saying we are not paying attention to reality. Hope is saying, okay, here's the reality, and this is what I'm hoping for. And that hope can be anything. It doesn't have to apply anyone else's logic or rationale as to, you know, how those things can coexist.
I'm reminded when Nicole is speaking about that, Allison brought in a wonderful paper by a friend of mine from the medical literature that talks about things that doctors say that they really shouldn't say around the time of death. And you've probably heard many of these. One is there's no hope, or there's nothing more that we can do, because there's always something that you can do. The other one that I just wanted to mention, because you may be on one or the other side of this conversation many times, is when doctors ask the question, do you want us to do everything? Terrible question. This actually happened when I was in medical school. My grandmother, who was quite elderly and had pretty advanced Alzheimer's disease, had had a massive heart attack and was, you know, essentially on life support in the critical care unit. And the doctors came to my father and said, "Do you want us to do everything for your mother?" Well, what could possibly be the answer to that question? Everyone says yes. It's the wrong question, of course, right? The question has to be something more like, well, here, tell me about this person. Here's the situation she's in now. You know, here are the things that we could do that would be reasonable. And so on. I mean, there are a lot of other ways to have that conversation, but clearly saying, do you want us to do everything is not one of those ways.
Another thing that he mentions, which happens often in my experience dealing with oncology people, he talks about the physician coming to the point of saying, there's nothing more we can do. And that's the wrong statement, because, of course, there are lots of things that can be done to provide comfort and company and spiritual support and so on. But the now in the world of oncology, where there are many huge technological advances, the table is tilted toward offering aggressive treatment, because that's how it's circumscribed for some physicians. That's what I have to offer. And physicians are not being trained or feel comfortable to stick around when there are no longer treatments that they could actually feel good about suggesting. And in fact, of course, many people are happy to have something suggested and end up not so happy to have having their last days with the discomfort of treatment that somebody with good judgment might not have offered if they felt they had other things to offer besides medicine. The way it happens often in my office is people come in horrified, or family members horrified, that they've essentially been abandoned, discharged. There's nothing more I can do. It signals them no hope, end of life. The physician they've been working with for years and years, and whom they developed a deep and abiding trust and relationship, is gone from them. And in fact, that's the case. That, you know, in oncology, the oncologist is no longer the treating physician, and people are experiencing a completely unnecessary abandonment. That's just another piece of this.
Nicole, you wanted to say something?
I was just going to suggest, actually, for you, if you wanted to speak more about palliative care. Palliative care being the term used for providing something that's focused on comfort and not necessarily on cure. And I say not necessarily because, ideally, palliative care is what everybody would receive in all of their care throughout their life. That it's not something that only starts because you decide that cure is not possible, but rather should accompany. And I think there are certainly movements in that direction, although there's also resistance in that direction.
You have to remember that all of this takes place in the context of a deeply irrational healthcare system. And so as Nicole says, part of the reason that palliative care has often been seen as something distinct from and in contrast to ordinary medical care is a purely administrative reason that, as often happens, then grows roots and becomes a culturally established reason. And that, the administrative reason that was that when hospice care first began to be provided in the United States in the 1970s, there was debate in the Medicare program, which was still relatively new, about whether it would pay for hospice care. And the decision was made that, and by the way, at the time, hospice care seemed very resource intensive. A lot of personnel involved in helping people out and so on. One of the ironies of that is that hospice care turns out to be much cheaper than most other kinds of care, as other care has become more technological. But in any case, at the time, Medicare made the decision that they would fund hospice care, but only if people agreed to forego curative care at the time. There was nothing inherent in the idea of providing hospice care or palliative care more generally that required that one stop efforts at treating the underlying disease, for example. But that was a decision that they made for administrative and cost containment reasons that then became part of the whole American culture of palliative care. There is some movement now, as palliative care has become more established, to try to extend the model, as you say, to other situations.
Just to say that from a healthcare consumer's perspective, that one can always ask at least the question of what are the palliative options at this point or in this situation. That does not have to only be asked of a doctor who is a specialist in palliative care, but rather that's a consideration that any of the medical caregivers, I hope, will be asked more and also be able to offer more answers to as we go forward.
Remember also that when we talk about medical personnel and doctors in particular, it is true that many are uncomfortable with conversation. Many, like most of us, are uncomfortable with conversation about issues like death. But even beyond all of that, physicians are trained to treat disease like the enemy and to do everything possible to try to treat it and cure it. In general, that's an inclination that we want our physicians to have, right? But it's therefore understandable when it gets to a point where really the priorities ought to be changing, that a lot of physicians have difficulty with that. It's personally very difficult. I just went through this past week with a patient who was very dear to me, who I'd taken care of for 13 years, who died a week ago. There was a lot of struggle for me around adjusting my goals and the ways that I was able to talk to him as he was clearly getting sicker and clearly was in a situation where there wasn't going to be any turning this disease process back. It felt like a failure on my part, like a defeat for me. Would I be letting him down by suggesting that, that the time had come to stop aggressive treatment and so on. So I'm not asking for extra sympathy for doctors, but just that you ought to be informed that there's a lot of psychology on the other side of these conversations that determines how they often go. The other thing I wanted to pick up before we kind of open up for some discussion, I think Nicole had mentioned that there's that commonly, and this has been talked about by some experts in this area, commonly when people are dying, the conversations that they want or need to have with the people around them have to do with expressing love, expressing or asking for forgiveness, saying goodbye, and so on. And I wanted to ask again all the panelists, let's start with you, Allison, about are there particular ways of trying to enhance those conversations to make them, make them easier for people to conduct, to encourage people who are having difficulty getting to these places?
Well, reflecting back to what you said earlier, not everyone wants to have these conversations. Whereas I read this Bill of Rights and I don't see them as things that must happen. I see them as following what people are wanting and needing. I feel the same way about people's inclinations around what they are able to do, what they want to do. People are pretty good usually at letting us know what's going on, whether they need help with something or whether they're not going to take a leap that they never took before, for instance. In this regard, we're talking a lot about conversation and communication. I feel like language is really important, and language of, forgive me, disease as the enemy or death as the enemy is problematic, and the battle with cancer, this kind of stuff. In terms of opening up the possibility of someone having the kind of conversation you're talking about, either in the family or the person who wants to be able to find words to say to family members or make amends or whatever it is, it's really helpful to get blame out of the system and get enemies and battles out of the system, or to find another way to view the realities and vicissitudes of life and death. And in our tradition, we can see both reward and punishment kind of language, as well as lovely, comforting language of eternity and being held and the naturalness of things. So if I'm talking to someone who may be having trouble articulating what they need help with, one way to try to open it up is to notice the language that's coming from that person and to see if they might not be burdened with a sense that they're in fact responsible for stuff that that I might not think they're responsible for, like their disease or like the impact of their disease on their family members or the finances or that kind of thing. So that whole kind of look into how we talk about this may open things up for people who otherwise would stay shut because there's shame and fear.
Thanks.